south of the Mason-Dixon. This is the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. Here is your host, Brian McClanahan.
Welcome back to the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. This is your host, Brian McClanahan, and this is episode 161, covering the week of March 11th through March 15th, 2019. Glad to have you back on the program. Very glad to be here. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Abbeville Institute, like our Facebook page at Abbeville Institute, and of course, subscribe to our YouTube page at Abbeville Institute. You can also support the Abbeville Institute by going to abbevilleinstitute.org. At the top of the page, you'll see a button that says support. Click on that, and you'll see donor options. You can donate monthly, annually, or a one-time donation. All of that is tax-deductible to the full extent of the law, so if you want to help us explore what is true and valuable in the Southern tradition, please consider a donation. While you're there, give us an email address, and we'll give you a free ebook, and you get our daily dose of Dixie Monday through Friday, and a weekly email on Saturday or Sunday, which includes a link to this podcast. You can also support the Institute by going to that same button that says support. You click on that, and you've got a option that allows you to buy apparel. So it says shop. Click on that, and you'll go out, and you'll see all of our Abbeville Institute apparel. It is a wonderful collection of materials. You got T-shirts, polo shirts, hats, golf towels, all kinds of cool stuff, fleece. So it's really worth your time to go out and get that. Again, embroidered material, so it's not screen printed. It is high quality. It will last. And of course, you've got our logo then on the stuff you've got on your body. So people will ask you about it. Hey, what is that Abbeville Institute thing? And you can tell them. So it's a way to advertise the Institute and also support the Institute. We get a few pennies from the purchases. And of course, always remember that we have conferences and other materials, other programs. We do have a summer school coming up in July. Details are forthcoming, but if you want to make plans, the summer school will be at Seabrook Island, South Carolina, and it will be the week of July 21st through 26th. So the topic's going to be the New South and Reconstruction, more focusing on the New South. So you're going to want to get to that. If you know a student that wants to go, you know somebody that's interested in Southern tradition, have them start thinking about the summer school. We do want students who are advanced high school, college, or college undergraduate or graduate students. And we always have a number of great students. So this is really for the students, but we also open it to the public as well. So be thinking about the summer school, July 21st through July 26, 2019, Seabrook Island, South Carolina. Again, details are forthcoming. We'll probably have that up on the website by the first part of April. So start making your plans. Okay, all of that said, let's talk about the week at the Institute. And of course, how can we go a whole week without talking about the crazed lefties and what's going on around the South and the things that are happening that you just, if this was 50 years ago, even during the height of the Civil Rights Movement, none of this stuff was contemplated. But here we are 50 years later, and it seems like on a daily basis, we have more crazed lefties out attacking statues or symbols, whatever it is. Somebody's trying to tear down something of Southern history. Now, one thing that's interesting, somebody actually posted in our private group. It's our closed group, a Facebook group. If you want to join, just go onto our Facebook page and ask to join the group. Somebody posted in that group, and it's a wonderful place for conversation for like-minded individuals, that they've gone out and done some research, and I think that we need to do more of this. And they started looking at how many monuments to Union soldiers there are in the North, and when were these monuments built? And so this person went out, I can't remember if it was New York or in Massachusetts, one of those two states, and they found that there were hundreds and hundreds of quote-unquote Civil War monuments, just like the Confederate monuments, in these little towns across the North, and they have a single soldier at the top, just like they do in the South, and they're dedicated to the soldiers. And so they were all built about the same time, about the same years. I mean, you start looking at this and start thinking logically, okay, so the North is building monuments, the South is building monuments. Gee, I wonder if it has anything to do with the fact that we're at 25 years out or 50 years out or 100 years out, and that's when people are starting to or 75 years out, and that's when people are starting to think about, you know, it'd be nice to honor the soldiers that are the men that were in our family that died or served, whatever the case may be, and this is what we want to do to honor their memory. Gee, that might be something interesting. No. See, those monuments were built to good men, while the southern monuments, it doesn't matter when they were built, those were to good men. The southern monuments were to evil devil incarnate here. We've got these people with horns and tails, and we have to make sure that they're torn down. You see, because they're the drunken vomit of civilization, as Sumner said, Charles Sumner said in the 1850s. This is the issue. The South, Southerners are just oligarchic jerks who simply wanted to abuse people. And so they have to be torn down, whereas these noble Union men, by the way, these noble Union men supported building Confederate statues. So, Confederate monuments. But regardless, these guys, they're okay because they fought for a noble cause of saving the Union, not freeing the slaves, because there were desertions when that became a war aim. Even though near the end of the war, that was essentially, the Emancipation Proclamation made ending slavery, at least in theory, a war aim. But some men, left the army because of that. Others reluctantly signed on and did it. Okay, well, if we're going to do this, might as well do that. But still, for several years, these men fought to save the Union, not free one slave. But hey, that's a noble cause, centralizing power, making sure we kill people because they want to exercise their right of self-determination. That's a good cause. So their statues are going to stay up. But those in the South, men who weren't fighting for slavery at all because they didn't own slaves. In fact, most of the Confederate soldiers didn't own slaves. They were fighting for independence, but that's an ignoble cause. So we can't have that one there. So we have to tear that down. I mean, this is the logic, the kindergarten logic of the left. You see, it's kindergarten. It doesn't pass for anything intellectual at all. But here we are. And in fact, the first piece of the week by Boyd Cathy talks about the Confederate Flag Day there, Confederate Flag Day in North Carolina and Raleigh. It's held every year. It has been for over 30 years. And now the lefties decide that they're going to go out and attack those that go to the Confederate Flag Day there in Raleigh, where they hoist a flag at the top of the old Capitol building, and they have a speaker come in. This year it was Jack Kerouac. And, of course, Boyd Cathy is one of the organizers of this event, has been for a while. And he is now attacked. So as these people are leaving the building, there has to be police there to protect the people who are at the building from the crazed lefties who are out there yelling and shouting and holding up signs and cussing at little kids. I mean, these people are just good people. They're just good people concerned that there are some evil devils in the old Capitol building there in Raleigh. So they have to come out and just yell obscenities at kids, because nothing says a good person like yelling obscenities at kids. When I think of good people, that's the first thing I think. I wonder if that good person yells obscenities at kids, because that really defines. I mean, how about Beto, all right, who talks about going out and running over kids? I mean, hey, what's the difference? You got a guy that wants to run over kids in college as a young man writing literature, and you've got people now that are yelling obscenities at kids. I mean, it seems like they go hand in hand, right? So what's the difference? No big deal. This is what we're going to do now. And so Boyd talks about how these people were holding up awful signs and who these people were. First of all, most of them are privileged white kids. These aren't people out there who are, they go to college in North Carolina, whether it's Duke or University of North Carolina. A lot of them don't work. I mean, they're living on mommy and daddy's dollar, and this is the kind of thing they do. They're professional malcontents, essentially, and it wasn't a group of people who were, downtrodden and shoved in the gutter by crushing poverty or by racism, whatever it is, whatever thing that it might be. These aren't your 1960s civil rights activists who are peacefully protesting legal segregation. These are people that are just living in their mommy and daddy's basement, or perhaps going to college somewhere on mommy and daddy's dollar, and they're out protesting because they've got to shove it in the face. And of course, Boyd also sent around an email from one of these people, and it's amazing. It's a comment that was placed on a website that the article also appeared on Reckoning.com. Which is a great website, reckoning.com. But this comment from this individual, I mean, these people are lunatics. Because they're just going to get in our face, and they're old. Boyd's old, and all these people are young, and this is the future. We're the future, and we're going to keep getting in your face. Essentially, they're advocating violence. This is French Revolutionary kind of nonsense. But that's where we are in America, where we have these people that firmly believe that Robespierre would be more desirable, and I mean, they don't say it, but I'm sure they would think so, than a simple monument to a Confederate soldier, where there are millions of people in the South descendant from those Confederate soldiers. But no, those people are all bad. Anybody that wants to say, hey, that's my ancestor, and leave that monument alone, no, you're evil now. Now think about what society we live in when that's the case, where you can't even honor your ancestors. How despicable is that? That is the sign of extreme decline of civilization. There's no other way to describe it. But that's where we are in 2019. So you got these crazed lefties who are out there shouting, yelling, getting in people's faces. And then on the other hand, you have the situation in Mississippi, which Paul Yarborough talks about on Wednesday, where you have some protesters on the University of Mississippi campus. When I say protesters, they weren't really protesters. They were just having a gathering to honor Confederate symbols and monuments. And so the University of Mississippi basketball team, in all of their infinite wisdom, decides they're going to take a knee during the national anthem, which, I mean, look, the national anthem shouldn't be played before every sporting event anyways. But regardless, they're going to take a knee. And they're going to show their solidarity with people who are opposed to these evil people that came on campus. You got the athletic director saying this, the basketball coach at University of Mississippi, and it's because all these people are just stupid. And so what Paul Yarborough says is that you have all these noble Mississippians, because this is our house, they say. Of course, these Mississippians are from places like New Jersey and I think Kansas or somewhere like that. But this is their house in Mississippi, and they're going to show these outsiders who are from Mississippi that they can't protest on their campus. So these Kansians and New Jerseyans and Pennsylvanians, wherever the heck else they're from, are going to show the real residents of Mississippi who have ancestors that fought in Mississippi that Mississippi is theirs. So, right, the carpetbaggers are going to show the real Mississippians that Mississippians don't know Mississippi history. This is how stupid this stuff is getting. And of course, it's just ridiculous. They're going to show these people that show up to honor their ancestors that fought in that war and died in that war or were wounded in that war, whatever the case may be. When you had 75% of the white Southern population fighting in the war, and numbers that would have, if you put them into modern perspective, I mean, you're talking about tens of millions of people that would have been killed in the United States in a war, if we looked at the same percentage numbers. And of course, 75% of the population, the number of people that were involved in that war, but all those people are bad. You see, you can't honor people that fought in that war because they were just bad. They're fighting for a bad, and it's not just the left that's saying this. The problem is you've got the neoconservatives saying this, you've got left libertarians saying this, you've got people that are supposedly quote-unquote conservative running around saying that Southerners were traitors, that Southerners were just oligarchic slave mongers, all of these kind of things. Basically, they're just regurgitating the Republican Party slogans of the 1850s. This is the real issue that we have now. It's the Republican Party. It's the grand old stupid party. And the opinion that what they said in the 1850s is law. I mean, they were all just speaking the truth. It's all what it was. This is perfectly accurate stuff. And so that's the slave power thesis. It's just ridiculous. And in fact, it's ahistorical, because real historians understood that the Southern history was much more nuanced than that, and that there was a lot of damaging rhetoric coming out of the North. And that damaging rhetoric was not always 100% accurate. In fact, it was inaccurate most of the time. This is where Thomas Fleming, the late historian, not the Thomas Fleming from Chronicles, wrote a book recently, just before he died. He published a book, and it's probably because he didn't want to publish it when he was in the height of his career, because he knew the backlash. But basically, he blamed the abolitionists, the radical abolitionists, for the war, for their rhetoric. He said, look, they're creating the problem because they're calling Southerners all kinds of nasty names. And what are the Southerners supposed to do? This didn't happen in the 18th century. There was a balance. Northerners may not have agreed with slavery. And Southerners, of course, were wrestling with it themselves. But as you start leveling up the attacks and ramping up the attacks on this, what are Southerners going to do? You're calling them all kinds. You're calling them the vomit of civilization. So what are you supposed? How are you supposed to talk to somebody when that's what they're calling you? It's virtually impossible. So, but this is where we are with that. Now, of course, then you have Phil Lee's piece on Thursday, "Leave Confederate Statues Alone," and he brings up a good point about this. When Vietnam veterans were coming back from Vietnam, these people were spit at and called all kinds of names. And there was a great movement to stop doing that. We're going to honor veterans. We're going to honor veterans. We're not going to call them baby killers and all kinds of other things. We're going to ensure that these people are respected. And so today, Vietnam veterans are respected. These were men doing their job. These were men who were drafted, who were sent over there, who didn't have a choice. But the problem is, this the same type of reverence or respect is not given for the Southern soldier in the war. And so in this piece, it's an interesting piece. He says, quote, "Few today appreciate the magnitude of their sacrifice. About 300,000 Confederate soldiers died when the region's population was only 9 million. If the United States were to suffer proportional casualties in a war today, our losses would total 11 million, which would be 26 times greater than our dead in World War II. Given such loss, the Confederate soldiers' surviving family members wanted to memorialize them. Memorial Day evolved after federal occupation troops observed Southern women spreading flowers upon the graves of their husbands, sons, and brothers during the war. A year after the war, the ladies of Columbus, Mississippi strewed flowers on the graves of both Confederate and Union dead in the town's Friendship Cemetery. Their gesture started a movement that spread in the North. May 30th became selected as National Memorial Day in 1868. Now, I'll quibble with this is actually the first annual observation was Columbus, Georgia, and that Columbus, Mississippi event took place the day before, but it was the ladies of Columbus, Georgia that organized this. Since the war had impoverished the South, the Southern ladies could do little more than lay down flowers. James Ryder Randall, who wrote the state song, "Maryland, My Maryland," actually wrote a poem about at Arlington, where he talks about how the ladies went out and tried to put flowers on the graves of Confederate soldiers at Arlington Cemetery, and they were run off by soldiers with bayonets. And then the flowers were moved, and they were placed on the Union soldiers' grave. Well, a storm came through the next day, and this is true events. A storm came through that day, and all the flowers were blown onto the Confederate soldiers' graves. It was divine intervention, right? So James Ryder Randall wrote a poem about that. It's very interesting. But he talks about how the sacrifice of these people, and he says, it took years, but eventually the public abandoned the mockers and gave Vietnam vets due credit, thereby underscoring the maxim, whoever marries the spirit of his age will find himself a widower in the next. Thus, we should be aware that decisions to tear down century-old monuments put us at risk for remorse in the future. Dishonoring such monuments demeans later generations of American warriors who were inspired by the courage of the Confederate soldier. Consider, for example, that post-Civil War Southerners consistently come to our nation's defense more readily than did other Americans. Presently, 44% of our military are from the South, even though it represents just 36% of the nation's population. And he gives some examples of great Southerners who fought in wars in the 20th century. And he says, finally, toppling Confederate statues has evolved into a mob sport with impunity for the vandals. Since such conduct requires no more courage than kicking a puppy, we may wonder what comes next. Arcata, California has already moved a statue of President McKinley. Notre Dame University has covered a mural that celebrates Christopher Columbus's discovery voyages. Anti-statue activists are behaving much like the leaders of the former Soviet Union, where censorship and rewritten history was part of the state's effort to ensure that the correct political spin was put on their history. In response, George Orwell warned, the most effective way to destroy people is to deny and obliterate their own understanding of their history. This is the question, and You know, things like, I think it was University of Pennsylvania, the students in all their infinite wisdom there in the literature department decided that William Shakespeare was white supremacist and he needed to come down. Now, this is indicative of the educational environment of our modern academy. These people don't know anything. And so it's not always their fault. You almost have to have pity for them because the professors that are teaching them don't know anything either. And they don't know anything because they're going to graduate school. And in graduate school, you don't really learn anything. Your learning takes place outside of that. You learn some of the fashionable trends. And this is where you get modern, where you get graduate students. It's just fresh out. They have ingested this slave power thesis because that's the modern trend. You have, for example, Matthew Karp there in Princeton is a big star now because he wrote a book bashing John C. Calhoun and slave power and Western expansion. Well, I mean, it takes a lot of courage to do that. I mean, to go out and stand out there and say, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to take down John C. Calhoun. I'm going to stick it to the man because nobody is attacking John C. Calhoun. I mean, this is how stupid these people really are. I mean, nobody, the entire world seems like is against John C. Calhoun. But no, this guy is trendy. He's on the edge. He's on the cutting edge of the historical profession because he's doing something nobody else has done. He's taken down the man. He's a socialist. So you've got Matthew Karp at Princeton, along with his fellow lefty buddies there, it's silly to think that these people are somehow on the cutting edge of society in anything. It's just the acceptable opinion, and so it's groupthink, and so this is what the historical profession thinks is great, which is why they say this book is great. So you're not really doing anything that's thought-provoking. You're just regurgitating 1850s nonsense. And that's all that's happening. Or 1840s nonsense, or, you know, whatever. Before the Republican Party, there were those slave power people who were running around, too. Or this is, you know, Kevin Cruz, his buddy at Princeton. Same thing. I mean, I'll never forget, I asked Kevin Cruz one time, he's a Twitter Brigade historian. He makes a lot of noise on Twitter and social media about how smart he is. And I asked him just to show me, give me one example of where a Confederate statue, the inscription was, and there's physical evidence that said this statue was dedicated to white supremacy. And so he showed me David Blight's book, which doesn't do any of that. He talks about some of these celebrations and how there were people there that were honoring the Confederacy, but that was his whole point. So I said, well, that doesn't show me anything. That David Blight's book doesn't even refute what I'm saying. And so he blocked me on Twitter because he couldn't come up with an example. These people just run around their own little world. They're just myopic. They don't know anything. And this is the problem that we have. And that's because, again, they're not learning anything. So it used to be that wasn't the case. It used to be that we actually had historians that understood the South and were nuanced about it. And one of the Friday piece by Vito Musumeli actually goes through the differences between the Confederate Constitution and the U.S. Constitution. I would be shocked if people like Matthew Karp have ever read the Confederate Constitution. Or Kevin Cruz, have ever read the Confederate Constitution? I would be absolutely shocked. I don't think they have. Because if they had, they would look and see, well, gee, the difference between the Confederate Constitution and the U.S. Constitution, there's a lot of them there, and it's not just slavery. In fact, there's not really a whole lot of difference between the Confederate Constitution and the U.S. Constitution in regard to slavery. Yes, slavery is explicitly recognized in the Confederate Constitution, and it says that the central government cannot abolish slavery, though, newsflash, the central government of the Confederacy was thinking about doing that at the end of the war, 1864. But regardless, at least Jefferson Davis was, there's no difference between that and the U.S. Constitution. Republicans openly said, before the war began, we cannot abolish slavery in the southern states. We don't have the power to abolish slavery. We cannot do it. In fact, the Corwin Amendment, which was really the Lincoln Amendment, said that. I mean, look, they were saying, we won't abolish slavery in the South. We'll even pass a constitutional amendment that says we won't do this. What's the difference between the Confederate Constitution and the U.S. Constitution on slavery then? The Confederate Constitution talked about the fugitive slaves and how, of course, they used the term slave and how that was required. But that was required in the U.S. Constitution. There's really no difference here. The states could do whatever they wanted in the Confederate Constitution. They could abolish slavery if they wanted. You could have free states in the Confederacy. No difference between the U.S. Constitution and Confederate Constitution. But there are differences on things like internal improvements and banking and spending. There are differences in the powers of the states where sovereignty is expressly recognized. There are differences in the powers of the executive branch. There are major differences, but these differences are not anything. What they show you is that the dispute between the North and the South was much larger than this issue of slavery. In fact, slavery was just part of a larger dispute between the North and the South that went all the way back to the ratification of the Constitution in the 1780s. So here we have a real problem that historians who are in the most prestigious institutions in the United States don't know anything. And of course, because they don't know anything, because all they get is their own little incestuous groupthink, because they don't know anything, we have a situation where the students that they teach don't know anything. And of course, then you have the last piece was a book review by Kirk Wood of the book Many Thousands Gone by Ira Berlin. Ira Berlin, it's a book about the first two centuries of slavery in North America. Ira Berlin is a very prominent historian. He taught at the University of Maryland. He was the editor of Freedom, A Documentary History of Emancipation, and he wrote this book about the first 200 years of slavery in America, and what he found was very nuanced. He talks about independent communities and some of the things that slaves... But this is the kind of history that historians used to write. This book was published in 1998. Might as well have been published in 1898. Might as well have been published 100 years ago. Because it seems like nobody knows this stuff anymore. This is just 20 years ago. People were actually still writing nuanced histories of the South and Southern history. You won't find this anymore. I mean, it was just 20 years ago that you had Eugene Genovese writing histories. Of course, he's dead now. But Eugene Genovese would be completely out of fashion nowadays because he wrote nuanced histories. He wrote Roll, Jordan, Roll, which was a nuanced history of slavery in the South. He actually took seriously Southerners and considered them to be smart people when he wrote The Mind of the Masterclass. I mean, you can't write these books anymore because they would be considered to be just apologetic for the South. And Genovese was critical of the South. But he took seriously their arguments, and he considered them to be intellectual people and he took their arguments seriously. They weren't just demons. They weren't just people with horns and tails. There was actually some nuance and something valuable to learn from them. And Genovese was on the record saying this. So he talks about the complicity, and Berlin does, the complicity of Africa in the slave trade. And this is something that you can't even say anymore. Why? I mean, we want to understand. If the job of a historian is to understand a people in a place, then you have to take everything together. And even if it doesn't fit with your political worldview, you have to write it. Kirk Wood says, if slavery varied over time, so did the African-American life and society with its rural versus urban communities. Free blacks and slaves, not to mention real differences between Creoles, Africans, and African-Americans that made for important and lingering class distinctions. Race, according to Professor Berlin, was not the only marker of status. Family life, we're informed, was more stable and sustainable for the charter and revolutionary generations because of more favorable male-to-female ratios and higher birth rates, and less so for the plantation generation. This disparity was the product of the plantation revolution of the 1700s and the great increase in demand for labor together with the less selectivity on the part of African slave raiders. And here began the infamous Middle Passage, of which North America was only a marginal participant, a point that Berlin does not make explicit. So we have a nuanced study of history and of this period. But again, this, if you put this book in front of these SJWs who are shouting profanities at kids in North Carolina, they wouldn't know what to do with it or the idiots who are kneeling at a basketball game in Mississippi, they wouldn't know what to do with it. They wouldn't know how to deal with this because that wouldn't make it wouldn't fit their worldview. And so that would be problematic for them. But that's where we are in 2019. This is why it's imperative that you support the Abbeville Institute and organizations like this, because we're the only ones, it seems like, anymore, who are out doing these type of things and making this clear to people that, you know, there is something valuable about the South. There's something valuable about the Southern tradition. We need to honor that. We need to remember it. Every tradition has its, as I've said before, is a rose. Every tradition is a rose. It's a beautiful flower, and it has its thorns. But there's something valuable about saving the bush, right? The rose bush. It's got the beautiful flowers. The thorns we can deal with. We'll have to. You don't want to prick yourself on those thorns. You don't want to grab it and just say we're going to accept this whole cloth. But you certainly want to preserve the flower and preserve the bush itself, and that's the tradition of the South, and it has something valuable to say about modern American society, and it has something valuable to say about Americans in general. So, with that said, until next time, good day.